Good afternoon. It's Friday, the 11th of January, 2009, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. Your host today, Mike Robertson, myself, Brian Gerrish, and we're delighted to be joined by David Scott. And David, of course, reporting from north of the border with Northern Exposure.
It is 2019, by the way.
Did I say nine?
Yes.
I am having a little problem adjusting to this year, but I'm sure it'll come good.
It'll come good, yes. Okay, well, we're going to get straight on because we've got, what's 100 years of British military air power to celebrate here, Brian. This is Gavin Williamson, the Minister of Secretary of State for War, is apparently setting sights on the next century of British air power as major fighter jet milestones are reached. This is what they're saying. He was speaking in a brand new hangar at RAF Marham yesterday. Here we do have a picture of him in 1 second. So here we go. Let's have a look. There he is speaking in the hangar. Apparently the UK now has 9 F-35 Lightning jets ready to be deployed in operations right around the world. F-35 Lightnings will form the backbone of the UK's combat air fleet alongside Typhoon jets, which Gavin Williamson also announced have now been fitted with what he described as state-of-the-art complex weapons suite to vastly increase its capability. This all comes under Project Centurion, which apparently is worth £425 million over the past 3 years. So the Typhoon now has Deep Strike Cruise Missile, Storm Shadow, Air-to-Air Missile, Meteor, and the Precision Attack Missile Brimstone at their disposal. So this is excellent stuff. This is what Gavin Williamson had to say. The incredible F-35 jets are ready for operations. A transformed Typhoon has the power to dominate the skies into the 2040s. And we continue to look even further at an ambitious future. So anyway, as I say, this is him at RAF Marham speaking in front of what's claimed to be an F-35. So I couldn't resist. I had to ask him, was it indeed a proper F-35 or was it made of cardboard? I actually got a response to this, not from Gavin Williamson, but from a Twitter account called British Defence Corrections, which apparently is set up in order to make corrections to false information. So because I suggested that the F-35 sitting behind Gavin Williamson was made out of cardboard, they felt they needed to comment. And so they said, firstly, it's not made of cardboard. It's a genuine aircraft. It apparently was flown over here last year and has been flying and exercises since. He went on to say, we are due to procure 138 aircraft. And although they're not fully British made, 13-15% of the overall components are. And I said, 13-15% of components made in Britain is an insult to the British aircraft industry. Are you proud of this? To which the response was, it's better than 0%. And I thought that was an absolutely shocking response. I don't really know who this is, whether this is a Ministry of Defence owned account or whether it's somebody that's a veteran that's decided to make corrections to anybody that they think are talking nonsense. But anyway, I wasn't particularly impressed with that response. So in the press release that the government released, they said British industry manufacturing 15% of a global order book of over 3,000 jets. I just wanted to sort of contrast that with, and I'm saying here, as opposed to British industry manufacturing 100% of a global order book of 550 Harriers, or British industry manufacturing 100% of a global order book of just under 2,000 Hunters. And of course, we also had Sea Vixens and Buccaneers and Gnats and Jaguars and Lightnings. And of course, some cancelled projects like TSR2, which would have been a world beater. We also had a supersonic Harrier on the drawing board as well, which was cancelled. So, you know, to suggest that we should be impressed with 15% of what, Brian?
Apparently 9 aircraft at the moment. But the other thing we can get to the bottom of is whether all of the problems had been fixed for the aircraft. We'll come on to that in a minute.
Yes. So, going back to this tweet from this organisation, of course, they said it's not made of cardboard. and so on. But I said, can you confirm that the corrosion problems, engine fires, oxygen supply problems, avionics bugs are all solved? Has the US Senate now lifted the embargo on Turkey so that we can have our F-35 engines serviced? Because, of course, the contract is to distribute the servicing of these aircraft across multiple countries, and Turkey has the contract for handling the engine issue. But of course, the US government has decided that it's not particularly appropriate for Turkey to have F-35s at the moment, even though they have actually bought some. And certainly not appropriate for them to have parts. So it might be difficult to service the engines under those circumstances. Well, they said that, the engine fire problem had been sorted out. And really, they weren't aware of any of the other problems, but the other problems have been well publicised.
Well publicised in a variety of defence journals and some mainstream articles. So we're a little bit puzzled about who's making the comments. But nevertheless, what a state of affairs. We're getting very excited because we've got 9 of these aircraft. But are they fit for service? Let's go back to Gavin Williamson's tweet on this. When I followed it through this morning, I was very interested to see this comment. The F-35 is still a developmental project, brackets, with many unsolved errors. They haven't even finished the very critical initial operational test and evaluation. Besides, there are other issues. And then it refers to an Inside Defense article saying that there's got to be massive cuts to costs in America for the Americans to operate the F-35A. Mm. So it's got to the point where if we see an announcement by the Defense Secretary, we have no idea of knowing if what he says is true. And certainly if we look at his comments, they simply don't stack up. 9 aircraft, and this man is saying we're going to dominate the world skies. David, if I may, we're seeing politicians now, they're not only not credible, they seem to be living in pure fantasy land.
It seems that way, but I suspect it's not. The reason it seems that way is it's a lie. There are many things about this that are tremendously troubling. There has been a decision to integrate defence procurement across the entire Western world. Now, that is not in the interest of this country should we wish to have an independent view of anything. It's part of a globalist agenda, and it's been settled on by our politicians without it being agreed in Parliament or discussed, let alone debated with the public. So you see that not only have we got 15% of this aircraft, I was looking into the much troubled USS Zumwalt, another unfortunate project with many problems, and apparently no ammunition for its guns. Now, that's an American ship, but it's got British engines, it's Rolls-Royce engines, and all of this weapon systems that work seem to be from British Aerospace, BAE Systems. So what you're seeing here is there's no part of any of this international community that can operate solo. It's being integrated. And this is one of David Ellis's points, that the EU military integration starts with procurement.
Absolutely does. Yes. But look, I just wanted to end on a slightly lighter note here, because, of course, I was criticised by British Defence Corrections for suggesting that the F-35 behind Gavin Williamson there was made of cardboard. Well, in fact, in the government press release, it said this: the year ahead will see that the F-35 Lightning pilots and ground crew continue learning how to operate and maintain the jets in the new centre at RAF Marham, which features state-of-the-art simulators, classrooms and physical aircraft mock-ups. So I have to say, ask the question once again, is this a genuine aircraft sitting in the background here, or is this a physical aircraft mock-up? And of course, we have seen physical aircraft mock-ups of F-35s before, because when they were commissioning the Queen Elizabeth aircraft carrier, many of the promotional photographs had a mock-up of the F-35 sitting on the deck. So perhaps the defence corrections or people would let us know for certain that this is a real aircraft.
Okay, well, it'd be interesting to see, Mike, what happens on that one.
Yeah. Okay, let's move on. So I just wanted to highlight the Daily Mail here. And just the sheer propaganda that they're pushing out on this. If you look at this article, don't mess with this. Defence Secretary Gavin Williamson warns Putin as Britain's new state-of-the-art stealth fighter squadron roars into frontline service.
This is children's comic, Mike.
Absolutely. I strongly recommend people go and have a look at this article. It is absolute children's comic, but it is some pretty egregious propaganda as well.
Absolutely. Well, let's go to the serious stuff. And of course, you pushed out a lot of tweets yesterday to do with the military. This one aimed at Admiral Lord Boyce. All of these comments are what is happening with defence as we hear all of the rhetoric over Brexit. And of course, Britain's military are not to be released from the European Union under the present arrangements. But fascinating to see that UK column did a lot of work yesterday on defence, and then suddenly out of the blue we've got a lot of excitement about a letter which has come from Richard Dearlove and Charles Guthrie, General Guthrie. So this was David Davis tweeting it out. Few people can match the expertise and patriotism of Richard Dearlove and Charles Guthrie. People should pay serious attention to their considered letter on why the Prime Minister's withdrawal agreement needs to be voted down next week. He was actually retweeting their part of this from Owen Paterson, MP. And we've got more from Owen Paterson, but we have got one page of the letter. Let's bring that up on screen. So this was sent to all the chairmen of Conservative Party associations. I'll just read it very quickly. Dear Chairman, your MP will shortly be called upon to support the Prime Minister's withdrawal agreement. As a former chief of the Secret Intelligence Service with my colleague Lord Guthrie, who served as chief of the defence staff shortly before I was in charge of MI6, we're taking the unprecedented step of writing to all Conservative Party chairmen to advise and warn you that this withdrawal agreement is not defeated, if not defeated, will threaten the national security of the country in fundamental ways. Please ensure that your MP does not vote for this bad agreement. On 29th of November, the attached letter to the Prime Minister was published. It explained that the withdrawal agreement threatens to change our national security policy by binding us into new sets of EU-controlled relationships. Buried in the agreement is the offer of a new, deep and special relationship with the EU in defence, security and intelligence, which cuts across the three fundamentals of our national security policy, that is membership of NATO, our close bilateral defence an intelligence relationship with the USA and the Five Eyes Intelligence Alliance. Number 10's immediate response to our letter showed we touched a raw nerve. However, their rebuttal indicated a worryingly poor understanding of the issues. That has got to be extremely hard-hitting stuff. I don't believe that Number 10's reply was they didn't really know. I don't think it was poor understanding. I think what we're seeing from Number 10 is the deliberate attempt to mislead the population in this country. But now, as a result of a lot of material that's been put out by the UK column, we're suddenly starting to see people focus on defence. Mm. David, I'll just ask you, is this an accident, do you think? This letter suddenly comes to press the morning after there was a very strong campaign to get defence in front of MPs yesterday.
I don't think any of this is accidental. We're also seeing the first of the MPs use the phrase EU military union. That was very significant. That was the MP for Berwick, I think. But there's a couple of things about this letter. It talks about a change, you know, the withdrawal process introduces a change which threatens our national security. It's not exactly a change. What the Prime Minister talks about is protecting our security, and that's code for not changing anything. So the processes that were already underway in the EU, which were already in train and which nobody in the political world was objecting to, have simply been revealed by Brexit. And people are starting to speak out. Had we not had this debate, all of these changes would have been introduced, and yep, we might well be none the wiser.
Absolutely. Okay, David, let's move on to Scottish issues, and we're going to start off with Alex Salmond. Now, he's been in the press the last few weeks, well, a bit longer than that, but I started noticing it a couple of weeks ago. He seems to be under a bit of pressure, and for such a Scottish establishment man, friend of Prince Charles and so on, I was a little bit surprised. So what is going on here?
What indeed. Now, the background to this is that Alex Salmond had been some sort of a accusation made by some female members of staff that dates back to 2014. This had some form of investigation. And then in December 2017, the rules were changed, which allowed a retrospective examination of certain issues. And then immediately the next month, allegations were brought forward to the Scottish Government and an investigation started. Now, this was then leaked to the press some months later, around about the middle of the year. And what it transpired is that Alex Salmond had been threatening sort of legal action to try and contain the situation, and was very unhappy with the way he had been treated. So he decided to go to judicial review, a very expensive process. He crowdfunded that. He got £100,000 to go to judicial review to test the fairness and lawfulness of the process that the Scottish Government had undertaken. Now, this, I thought, was a very astute move, because knowing it was Leslie Evans and Nicola Sturgeon at the back of this, I thought that the chances of the process being sound were small. It transpired that both he and I were right, and the decision here has been that the Scottish Government accepts that the process has been unlawful and procedurally unfair and tainted by apparent bias. This was after day one of the judicial review. So essentially, as soon as things got to court, the government case fell apart and it was all conceded. So the next slide you see here is a very angry and gaunt-looking Alex Salmond standing outside the court of session. Now, what he said there, amongst other things, is that Leslie Evans, who's the head of the Scottish Civil Service, should resign, because she was principally in charge of this investigation, and he considers that it was so badly handled and so clearly subject to bias as to warrant her resignation. It's worth just quickly going through what he did say. From written and verbal statements he made outside the court. He said, as I reflect on the last difficult months, I'm mindful of three things. First, this process was completely unnecessary. Over the last year, my legal team repeatedly offered the Scottish Government legal arbitration to resolve any complaints and establish the illegality of this process without the need for such a damaging and expensive case to come to court. To my great regret, all such proposals were rejected, leaving me with no choice but to bring this matter to the court of session. As a result, Leslie Evans, Permanent Secretary, has wasted huge amounts of government money. I understand, by the way, it's about £500,000, in an incompetent attempt to enforce an unlawful process. Now, having incurred these costs to the public purse, has collapsed the case prior to the hearing. He then went on, secondly, the Scottish Government's conduct in this case has unquestionably lacked candour. Officials repeatedly failed to disclose documents to the court which were of central importance. These documents ultimately made clear the apparent bias and procedural unfairness which has now been admitted. As a former First Minister, I find this conduct entirely unworthy. These documents remain confidential. Now, this is critical. These documents remain confidential as part of the court process for now, but in my view, they reveal a clear and obvious breach of the principles of fairness and natural justice. It's a matter of great personal sadness that I've had to bring the Scottish Government to court, etc. So what he's saying is that there are documents which are so damning that they collapse the case, but they're still confidential, and the Scottish people can't see how the Scottish Government has been treating the former Scottish First Minister. So I do have a certain amount of sympathy with his point there. And his third area of complaint was that the whole thing had been leaked to the press. He says, thirdly, I want to recall my profound unease about systematic leaking this matter from wherever that occurred. More on that in a minute. Any complaint processes need to be confidential. Leaking these details to the media, rights of privacy and confidentiality have been blatantly disregarded. This was done deliberately to inflict the maximum damage to my reputation. So what he's saying here is somebody has leaked everything to the press to take him out politically. Now, what I'm hearing is that somebody was actually Nicola Sturgeon personally. We will see if that is revealed.
Very interesting state of affairs. Doesn't it reflect government that we're seeing wherever it is in UK, whether it's the Westminster government north of the border, we're seeing it in Wales. Mm. We've also seen it in over in Northern Ireland. One rule for us, a totally different rule for the governing elite.
That's an excellent point, Brian, because it shows you that the governing elite will go after anybody, including people who were, quote, their own. And unless you can have access to a minimum of £100,000, you have no access to justice. So if that is anybody else, then they will be stitched up. Robert Green has had interactions with Leslie Evans trying to find out how the case against him was funded, the private civil action against him was funded. We asked Leslie Evans questions. She just wrote back and said, I've taken advice from the Lord Advocate and I'm not going to talk to you. There was no pretense that she could answer the questions. The questions were procedural and to do with the law and to do with the regulations governing government. And she just said, I don't care, get lost. That's how the ordinary people are treated.
Mm. Yeah. Okay, well, let's move on. Another Scottish story here. More than 1,000 murders in Scotland left unresolved. Police Scotland don't seem to do a terribly great job.
Ah, no. You see, this is where you're wrong. If you ask Police Scotland do a tremendous job because almost no murders in Scotland are unsolved, right? And this is a story of a journalist investigating this headline because the Police Scotland put out an announcement that in the last 10 years have solved all murders, right? And the journalist thought, well, that doesn't sound right because I've covered a lot of these stories and there's been no trials. Transpires that the Scottish Police Service have a definition of solved, which includes if they think they know who did it, but have no evidence and nothing's been brought to court, right? These are unresolved, but solved. Are you with me so far? Right? And there's over 1,000 of these cases where the police think they know who did it, but have no evidence, can't bring the thing to court, or it hasn't gone to court for whatever reason. And the case has just kind of died. But you have to understand, these are not unsolved cases.
And I have to say, and of course, where people die in police custody, particularly in Scotland, it gets a little bit complex, doesn't it? Because did they solve it because they actually knew they did it, but they denied it to the public? Or?
Well, who knows? Because because all of this is confidential, so you wouldn't know. So this is another thing where it's all behind closed doors. Nobody knows why these cases haven't been brought. You have a whole series, and this article is looking at one case, of the grieving relatives of those who have been killed, trying to get justice and fighting for decades without success.
Is this because Police Scotland may be involved in some of these situations?
I wouldn't like to say, Mike.
Okay. Well, let's move on quickly then to ex-Celtic Boys Club chairman spared jail over child abuse. So the Scottish judiciary doing as good a job then?
Well, I just wanted to put this in as a kind of data point. This is how people who are convicted of child abuse are treated. So this man here was part of Celtic Boys Club, a football club, which is mired in sexual abuse revelations now. And he was also a teacher, and he's been convicted of lewd and libidinous practices towards five victims between 84 and 89. The victims were between 9 and 13 years of age. Having been convicted of this, including taking photographs and exposing himself and all sorts of nasty stuff, he was given probation and 240 hours community service. So you assault five children, doing who knows what damage to them psychologically, that equals probation and 240 hours community service. I think that's an interesting data point for where we are.
Yes.
And let's reinforce that by putting Sabine McNeill on screen. Now, of course, we can expect the press to be ripping into her, led by The Telegraph. UK's worst troll claimed London school was centre of baby-eating satanic cult. Typical headline, because, of course, The Telegraph itself did no proper investigation into what took place in Hampstead. And we can also say that actually it wasn't Sabine that claimed that, it was the children that claimed that. But of course, we did not have a full and proper investigation as to what actually took place. But the sentence is 9 years. I've labelled it Mind the Gap in British Justice. You've just given an example north of the board, David, but I'll choose this one, the Daily Mail. We've got a football thug, man describes a football thug, who is attracted to pre-op transgender males, is jailed for having sex with a vulnerable 14-year-old femme boy with Asperger's. So he finds this young man on the internet, he grooms him, he takes him off, he abuses him. He gets a sentence of 6 years, and on the left of our screen we've got Sabine, who gets a sentence of 9 years. And I'll say, if Hampstead was simply a complete hoax, then what was the big fuss about when this elderly lady started to kick up a stink about it? What was the big problem? Because it was all such nonsense, how could anybody be offended? But there we are on screen. Now, I understand it was the same judge. I think it's a lady called Carhill. 9 years for Sabine, 6 years for the other gentleman. And you've given us an example north of the border. Well, while we think of that, let's go here to Gloucester. And thank you very much to the lady who alerted us to this headline from the Wilts and Gloucestershire Standard. Traffic children go missing from council care. Let's have a look at what was said. The extent of Gloucestershire's illegal trade of children, which sees minors sexually exploited, forced to work or marry, and coerced into crime, has been revealed by a Freedom of Information request made by Unseen, a charity which runs a safe house in the southwest for victims of modern slavery. The FOI to Gloucestershire County Council also disclosed that some of the children went missing from the council's care. Once it has identified trafficked children, the council tries to place them into foster care, supported accommodation or children's home. Now, this is the key bit. This number is less than five, the council's FOI team told Unseen, though how many exactly was kept secret to prevent unintentionally identifying cases. So, David, we've got a bit of your stuff here that the government, when it needs to cover up how many children have gone missing from its own facilities, been trafficked and abused, I'm afraid we can't tell the public because that protects the children. Well, this story gets better because the eagle-eyed viewer of UK columns spotted the name Reznicek, Julie Reznicek, and she's quoted in the article as Director of Safeguarding and Care of the County Council. And Julie said that given that traffickers often promise children benefits or threaten children to a corporation, the key task is to engage children and young people and to divert them from these threats and promises. In the early stages of children's services involvement, it's symptomatic of trafficking that some children will be drawn back to their traffickers and have gone missing on occasion. Keeping children and young people safe and well is our top priority. So this is astonishing stuff. We were also alerted to the fact that in October 2017, Gloucestershire Child Children's Protection Services were rated inadequate. And of course, our mind was cast back to 2008 when the UK column published what was truly a horrific story of a young girl being taken away from her mother because she hadn't attended school. Why? Because the girl was seriously ill. These were some of the things that we highlighted, that there'd been a failure to diagnose a serious illness. There'd been a removal of the girl's healthy appendix by Neath Hospital, which had no licence to operate. There had been a cover-up of the severe post-operative abscess. There'd been excessive prescription of drugs, negligent prescription of oral morphine, incorrect discharge and prescription forms, confused and incompetent hospital referrals, and a blatant denial of Bonnie's pain by doctors and social workers when they captured her from her mother in Florida. We were able to see all of the court documents relating to this. And one of the judges even casually said, well, at the time the child was taken to the state, he did not think it was breaching any existing care orders. However, the local authority went and took the girl. This was a quote in 2002 by Neathport Talbot councillor Davies, and he wrote this: "I believe that we, Neathport Talbot Borough Council, were not entitled to go there, the USA. We relied on orders that were invalid, and there's a possibility that we may have misled the courts when those original orders were made. And Bonnie has never been reunited with her mother. Our headline stood at the time, Bonnie Lewis kidnapped by the state. And the evidence is that that report was 100% accurate and incredibly frightening, because back then we were seeing that basically local authorities were beyond the law."
And the key point here for our listeners who can't see the screen, of course, it's the same Resnicek that was in charge of Neathport Talbot Social Services at that time.
Absolutely, Mike. And I'm going to say thank you again to that very sharp-eyed viewer that picked up the name Resnicek. So there we have Gloucester. And as The Guardian reported, one of 33 authorities, fascinating number, one of 33 authorities absolutely failing to protect children. What can we say? It's blatant. Well, let's change subject and come on to this headline, because UK Columns consistently warned that we're seeing Britain stripped of any manufacturing capability. Here's the Telegraph's headline: Jaguar Land Rover, how EU rules left Slovakia free to entice the car maker from UK with $110 million state aid sweetener. And this is about losses for Jaguar Land Rover, where they're talking about moving production of the Land Rover Discovery model from Solihull to Slovakia. So that'll create 2,350 jobs in Eastern Europe rather than the UK, but it's receiving little scrutiny. Now, I was fascinated that through another matter, my attention was drawn to Mark Sedwill, who's now the head of the civil service. And on his Twitter page, I noticed that he'd been involved with something happening in India. And when you followed it through, this was the little thing. Mark Sedwill, National Security Advisor, in conversation with the Foreign Secretary of India. If I bring this up on screen, it was a dialogue about a world reorder. So we can't keep jobs in Britain. We can't support our own industry. But this man is glad-handing people in India and talking about reordering the world. But it gets worse, because this organisation, ORF, was actually set up, let's see if I can find it here, to work towards building a strong and prosperous India. So this is nothing about helping workers in UK. This is all about India. And we ask, was the plan to strip Land Rover, was that discussed as part of these talks? We have no way of knowing, because there doesn't seem to be any minutes. And then we take you back to 2013, where UK Column alone was warning about the dangers of common purpose, then being supported by David Cameron. And what was Common Purpose doing? Helping to boost Indian leaders. And they had a conference here at a venue owned by Tata, the Indian industrial conglomerate, which brings us back to the car manufacturing. David, it's pretty obvious that we haven't got politics being carried out in Westminster. There is no real politics carried out in the House. We've got these think tanks and groups making policy behind closed doors. This is a very dangerous period that we're in UK at the moment.
And it's a continuation of a process that's been going on for over 100 years. If you go back to the minutes of the Carnegie Foundation just before the First World War, they're discussing how to change society, and they're discussing, is there any better way than a war? And when they decide there isn't, they're then discussing ways of getting America into a war in order to change the society. And the reason for all of this is facing towards not a capitalist, not a free market, but a centrally state-controlled, unified, single one world order. This is the thing they're discussing. They're talking about at that point how to make the United States, into the 50s, they're talking about how to make the United States compatible with being integrated with the Soviet Union. So you see this long process of globalization, and you're not seeing anything to do with the nation being allowed to be said. You're painted, we'll come to this later, you're painted as a Nazi and a right-wing extremist, all the rest of it. If you actually stand up for national interest, we see this with Trump, we see this with the protesters outside Westminster. You're not allowed to have a nation, you're not allowed to believe in your nation, because it's a point, like the family, it's a point of resistance to this process.
Totally agree. And that is the rules-based international order, as Theresa May and other politicians call it.
Okay, let's come back onto the subject of Integrity Initiative. And now, this isn't really about them in particular, but as David's short briefing paper pointed out, the Integrity Initiative is part of a UK government counter-disinformation and media development programme. Now, as many people that have been watching the UK column for some time will know, I've been chasing this programme within the Foreign and Commonwealth Office for quite some time, and particularly this man, Andy Price, the head of counter-disinformation and media development. Now, of course, the Integrity Initiative, I should say that I've been chasing this man initially through Freedom of Information, and back in January last year, I asked. So that's about a year ago. I asked the Foreign and Commonwealth Office for some information on the background on the role currently held by Andy Price, and I said, "Could you please tell me the scope of the role, the size of the team that he has working with him, and when the role was created?" Now, of course, the Foreign Office refused that request, and it went to the Information Commissioner for appeal and so on. But we'll come on to that subject in a second. In the meantime, the Integrity Initiative documents were leaked via Anonymous. And as a result of our coverage and coverage by one or two mainstream outlets, well, this MP, Chris Williamson, asked some questions in the House. So I'm just going to remind everybody about the questions that he asked because they're relevant here. He first asked to ask the Secretary of State for Foreign and Commonwealth Affairs, pursuant to the answer of 3rd of December 2018, to question 196177 on Foreign and Commonwealth Office Integrity Initiative, if he will publish his department's documents and correspondence on grant agreements for the Integrity Initiative. And he said the answer to that was that the Foreign Office Counter Disinformation and Media Development Programme is designed to protect national security by countering disinformation directed at the UK and its allies from Russia. Russia persistently uses disinformation to target its perceived enemies. An example was the Russian disinformation campaign that followed the attack in Salisbury, which was intended to distract from Russian culpability. Documents and correspondence about projects within the programme will not be published, as this information could then be used to actively attempt to disrupt and undermine the program's effectiveness. So keep these answers in mind because you'll see why they become relevant in a second. Another of the questions that Chris Williamson asked was to ask the Secretary of State for Foreign and Commonwealth Affairs what the amount and the recipient name was for grants paid through the Foreign Office Russian Language Program in the latest period for which figures are available. And the answer was that the Foreign Office's disinformation media development program is designed to protect, and so it went on. It was basically exactly the same answer as for the previous question, so therefore he didn't really answer the question. But anyway, another of the questions that Chris Williamson asked was to ask the Secretary of State for Foreign and Commonwealth Affairs, pursuant to another question, whether the funding provided to the Institute for Statecraft was through the FCO-led Russian language program. And the answer that was given was that the Russian language program was launched in 2014 following Russia's illegal annexation of Crimea. In April 2016, we launched a new four-year strategic communications and media development program authorized by the National Security Council called the Counter Disinformation and Media Development Program. The former Russian language program was amalgamated into this. The funding provided to the Institute for Statecraft was funded from the Counter Disinformation and Media Development Program. It went on to say the Foreign Office's Russian language program was launched in 2014, and so on. Right, sorry, that's a duplication. But anyway, the point is, this was information that I had been attempting to get hold of, and the Foreign Office was absolutely refusing to tell me about on the basis of national security. And as the point that I made was that the use of national security to refuse information under the Freedom of Information Act can only be done whenever we're talking about some kind of intelligence operation, intelligence-led operation. So let's bring Mark Sedwell, that we've had on the program already.
He's a busy boy.
He's a busy boy, yes.
Busy
now,
boy.
As you pointed out, Brian, he is head of the National Security Council. He's recently been made head of the Cabinet Office and head of the British Civil Service. And as head of the British Civil Service, he, of course, is effectively in charge of the Foreign Commonwealth Office, at least as far as the officials are concerned. They have set up this counter disinformation and media development program. We have Andy Price in charge of that, and that is funding has been funding the Institute for Statecraft and the Integrity Initiative. But the question then comes back: who is Andy Price? What's the size of his team? Can we know anything about him? And apparently, the answer to that is no. Well, anyway, I've been in contact and discussing this with the Information Commissioner for quite some time. And eventually, just before Christmas, I got this letter through from them. Dear Mr. Robinson, further to our brief telephone conversation earlier this week, I can confirm that I've received a response from the Foreign Office in relation to your complaint. The Foreign Office has explained that in addition to Section 24, National Security, it also considers Section 27, International Relations, and Section 40, Personal Data of the Freedom of Information Act, to apply to the information falling within the scope of your requests. Now, I have to say that as this entire process, which has been running for a year, had gone on, the Foreign Office had attempted to use initially other parts of the Freedom of Information Act to avoid answering this question. They eventually settled on national security, and now they're bringing in international relations and personal data into the thing as well. Well, in fact, I hadn't asked for any personal data. I was asking pretty generic questions, so this is nonsense. But anyway, the ICO letter goes on. However, the FCO has, that's the Foreign Office, has indicated that it's prepared to disclose some information to you at this stage, and I have asked it to do this, copying me into the correspondence with you. I meet with the Foreign Office on Wednesday, that was the Wednesday before Christmas, in order to examine the information falling within the scope of this request, which the Foreign Office is seeking to withhold. Therefore, when I return to the office in the new year, I'll be able to, in a position to draft a decision notice and so on. So that's what the Information Commissioner said. And in fact, the Foreign Office has now responded to the efforts of the Information Commissioner. And this is what they said. The government takes the issue of disinformation as well as wider online manipulation very seriously. Disinformation is a deliberate creation and dissemination of false and or manipulated information that is intended to deceive and mislead audiences. Just think of the Integrity Initiative as you read that. But anyway, it goes on. The Russian government persistently uses disinformation as a tool to destabilize perceived enemies. This was evident in the sustained Russian disinformation campaign following the attack in Salisbury, Russia's illegal annexation of Crimea, and remains so with Russia's destabilization of East Ukraine and beyond. We will continue to work with EU and international partners to constrain the Russian government's ability to use disinformation and propaganda. The Prime Minister announced at the Eastern Partnership Summit last year that the UK would be spending around £100 million over 5 years in the Eastern neighbourhood to counter disinformation. It is as important as ever that Russian speakers, wherever they are, have a choice in the media they consume and are able to access reliable and objective information. It is therefore vital that local, public and independent media serving Russian-speaking audiences can flourish. This financial year, we are investing approximately £8 million in supporting public service and independent media. This includes projects in the Baltic states, Ukraine, as well as pan-regional initiatives. In addition, we're working with governments of the Baltic states alongside the British Council and others, and other partners, to address issues such as media literacy and societal integration. Well, one of the organisations that does that specifically, I'm talking about the media literacy and societal integration issue, is BBC Media Action. Yeah. And if anybody isn't aware of BBC Media Action, please have a look in the UK column website for this article, BBC Media Action, Subversion from Broadcasting House to Kazakhstan. And I'll just make the point that in the most recent statistics that I've seen from the Foreign Office with regard to their spending, and that was for October 2018, They gave BBC Media Action £895,770 in that 1 month alone. So this is not an insignificant amount of Foreign Office funding.
But it's a charity, Mike, isn't it? Let's remember this thing is calling itself a charity.
And what's it doing? It's going into other countries, training journalists in the BBC way of doing things. It's providing, encouraging people to set up, soap operas that are designed to produce societal change and so on. So it's Change Agency, and we've got other projects going on. A new program, according to Slate here, helped bring better media literacy to Ukraine. And I'm just going to say, if we think of Ms. Zaghari Ratcliffe, who's unfortunately in prison in Iran at the moment, Iran accusing her of attempting to destabilize Iran by doing exactly this type of thing. And I'm just going to ask again, what was she doing? Was she involved? We know that she did work for BBC Media Action as a project manager at one point. She was working for the Thomson Reuters Foundation when she was arrested and imprisoned. But we have, David, we have what seems to be a concerted effort by the Foreign Office to subvert and interfere in foreign countries through their media, and to suggest that the Russians are doing this in this country or in the United States is obscene hypocrisy, isn't it?
It's very strange, because we've kind of changed sides. Because if you go back to the Soviet era, there was a disinformation campaign. It was so thorough that even the Russian definition of disinformation in the dictionary was itself disinformation. And they had this whole process of destabilization, of demoralization of the West. And as the Cold War came to an end, right, rather than peace, harmony, universal justice and abundance breaking out, we've actually seen that the West has adopted the tactics that we used to oppose. And we're now blatantly and obviously trying to subvert the belief system of the Russian people in order to get political ends satisfied. And those political ends aren't even being debated in their own parliament. It's astonishing.
Yes. Okay, look, we're right out of time, David, but we're going to do an extra time today for UK call members. But just before we go, let's briefly cover this, if we could, because you wanted to make a point about the whole Anna Soubry scandal from earlier in the week.
Well, this is a really significant point. And there's been a few brave voices have put their head above the parapet and defended the people outside Parliament who were criticising Soubry. I watched it with interest. The people were not threatening her. They were loud, right? They were singing, actually surprisingly tunefully, right? And they were certainly trying to annoy her. But you don't have a right in this country not to be annoyed. Now, the people who've stood up, Brendan O'Neill, who's been excellent, he did a piece you see here in Spiked. He said, I know how Anna Soubry feels. And he's explaining that anyone who supported Brexit has been called a Nazi for the past 2 years. He hasn't liked it. And he sympathises with her and says, well, I'm glad it's only happened to you once or twice. We've had this for years. And also here you see a debate that was on Scottish television. And this is two politicians raising constantly the Joe Cox murder and equating loud objection to what the politicians are doing with the Joe Cox murder and kind of conflating the two. And you had one brave voice speaking out against that and saying that it's necessary for people who are in marginalised parts of society who don't have a voice to be able to have a voice in the faces of the politicians, not to threaten, not to have violence, but to make their point robustly. And he's right. So I thought that Soubry was showing a vulnerability that ignores the fact that she has been calling, and people on her side of the political spectrum have been calling anyone with a view that this country should be independent a Nazi and bringing up appeasement and all sorts of things from history that are entirely inappropriate, and they don't like it when this situation is reversed and they become the target of similar comments.
Absolutely.
Okay, David, thank you very much for joining us. What's happening in UK? We say a dictatorship is installing itself very quickly. Can it be stopped? Of course, but it requires many people to speak out. We'll be covering more about that in the coming weeks. Thank you for joining us. We will be back at the same time on Monday. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.